Did you know buying, selling, fixing houses, and investing in real estate is easier than you think? All you need is help from a couple of experts who flipped hundreds of houses, seen most situations, and are here to share their knowledge with you. Welcome to the Real Estate Boys radio show and podcast. Now, Andrew Job and J.R. Reed from PerinaProperties.com.
Hello, Rounders. How are you guys doing today? So excited to have y'all. You tried and true listeners, I hope you noticed there was a little bit of a difference today.
Yeah, we have a new intro.
We do have a new intro. Way to go, Mr. Reed. That's impressive.
The Real Estate Boys. Don't give me the credit.
Okay.
Producer Will.
Came up with that.
He did.
You guys will still be affectionately known as the Rounders for now until we have a better name for you guys. But let's get into the show, man. I'm super excited. We've got an amazing guest today.
Yeah.
Somebody who we met part of our community, our bigger community, at you've heard us talk about on the show before, Collective Genius Mastermind that we go to. But you want to do the intros?
For sure. I'd love to. So we're extremely excited to have Mr. Casey Gregerson from Bighorn Capital Fund and Wyoming Off-Market Properties come and talk to us today. What's up, Casey?
How you guys doing?
Good, man. Happy to have you on the show.
Absolutely.
So we're going to jump into Casey's story. He's doing huge things with multifamily deals up in Wyoming and Montana, I think, as well. He's doing a lot of creative finance. He's big into the Sub2 community, which is put on by Mr. Pace Morby himself, and helping a lot of people inside of there close a lot of their own first deals and helping them get deals done. And so we're going to hear all kinds about creative finance, off-market deals, and really some multifamily stuff that you've got going on. So we want to know, how did you end up in this wonderful world of real estate?
Yeah, man. Well, first off, it's cool to be here in Houston doing a podcast, all right? Like most of your stuff we're doing on Zoom these days, but get to come do one face-to-face.
Yeah.
Appreciate you guys.
On the radio.
That's right. Even better.
The old airwaves.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what got me here. Actually, when I was little, the reason I went to college undergrad to be a major in communications because I wanted to be a sports announcer. I wanted to be a play-by-play radio announcer. That was like my goal growing up as a kid because I love sports. Growing up in Wyoming, and back then, I'm just sharing a back in the day story, but like the games weren't all on TV, so we literally listened to all the games on the radio. So I remember doing that, and my goal was to call the games for the Wyoming Cowboys someday.
Nice.
That's cool. Did you do it as a kid? Like, did you practice?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. We used to we'd play NCAA football all the time, and we'd be like, I'd be like, all right, now here's my chance. I'd be giving the play by play by while my buddies were playing I was playing against my brother.
They're like, Casey, shut up.
We're just trying to play video games.
I love that. That's awesome, cool. Man.
I even did an internship back in sixth or seventh grade, and I went and helped the local radio guy that did the sports games.
Did you really?
Yeah, I would just be on. I did a read at halftime. I got to read the stats, but other than that, I was just tagging along, which was cool.
I mean, that's a big deal at that age.
Oh yeah,
like being on the radio for any amount of time.
Oh yeah.
So this is in Wyoming. Where in Wyoming was this?
Yeah, so I grew up in Sheridan, Wyoming, up in the northern part, and yeah, it was a KROE. I remember Trevor Jackson, the late Trevor Jackson.
Was it country music?
Man, they were, we listened to a lot of country music, but it was on the AM stations that did all the sports games.
That's cool. That's super cool. Well, man, I think for the Rounders, which is what we call our listeners, I think them getting to hear how you got started into this business would be huge for them, because there's a lot of people who are just like you were before, because I'm familiar with your story of being in oil and gas. There might not be as many, you know, Divisional One quarterbacks out there listening to the show, but there's definitely a lot of oil and gas folks here that listen to this show, and they would love to hear how you made the transition from being in corporate America and in oil and gas and made it over to being a full-time investor.
Yeah, man. And there's a lot of little things that went into it, and I could go for an hour, but I'll give you the cliff notes and stop me if you need to. But I think it all starts when it was really my first property in 2010. So I would just gone to grad school. So as you mentioned, I had played football at undergrad up in Billings, Montana, and had the opportunity to go to grad school. Well, I guess at that point I always joke, I mean, I went for 5 years at the school, right? Because I played football. We got a red shirt. And rather than all my other buddies that screwed around, I was like, I'm going to at least get as much as I can out of this, out of being in school, right? So I got a double major in math and chemistry and a minor in physics and Spanish, right? But
wow.
But all, it's wow, right? But all that together, what the hell are you going to do with that, right?
That's true.
So I could have been like a math.
History.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe a math teacher, maybe a chemist. But I was always kind of drawn to math and engineering. So I got accepted into the petroleum engineering program at Wyoming. And that was the first time I'm like, all right, now I can actually see myself doing something. Or what, it was finally defined what I thought I'd do for the rest of my life. So yeah, I went to 2 years at Wyoming. But while I was there, that's where the real estate journey started. So my roommate actually, and then this college town, a lot of people will go sell a lot of dads or whatever, dads or moms, they'll go buy a house in Laramie for their kids to go to because they got multiple kids, and they'll keep the house and they'll keep it for all their kids. And when their kids all graduate, they will sell the house. So that's exactly what happened. My buddy, my roommate, he was the youngest of his family. His dad was ready to sell the house. He's like, hey, Casey, why doesn't your dad buy this house? And I'm like, I don't know. I'll ask him. So I went to my dad. I'm like, hey, dad, what do you think about buying this house? Because I had 2 more years. And he's like, well, I mean, I might be willing to help you buy it. So we kind of went down that path, and ultimately he co-signed on that house with me, and he used about $10,000 of my college savings to go put into the house. And we bought my first house, and to what we now today call house hacking, my roommates all paid my rent. And for now, and man, I was, at the time I was living off of a stipend, which was cool, right? I was actually excited that I didn't have to pay for school. They paid for my school, gave me like $1,500 a month to do research, but which wasn't a lot. But because I now had my mortgage covered because my roommates were paying it, it was like the first, it was cool, right? Yeah. And so that was the first one, right? And when I took my first job in Houston in 2012 for Shell, I go to work, right? And I keep that house, but I didn't really do anything. And I was lucky, actually. My brother came to school after me and went to law school, Wyoming. So he stayed there for 3 years and made it an easy transition for me to keep the house. And he lived in it, so I had somebody I could trust. But eventually, moved out. And when he moved out, I made a little bit more money on it. And I just did this for like 5 years, right? That was 2010 I bought it, and didn't really take a whole lot of action until, like a lot of people, 2015. I'll never forget it. I was still working on the rigs. I was working in the field. And the reason I was able to do this and get to where I'm at a lot, there's a lot of things, but one of the catalysts was I worked in the field, and I would work for 2 weeks on a drilling rig. I'd be working nights or doing something out on the rig, right? And then I'd have 2 weeks off to where I didn't have to do anything. I didn't even have to open my work laptop or cell phone. Like, I could just show up in 2 weeks and go back to work. So that's when I started investing in real estate. But what got me down the journey, like a lot of people, was reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad. So I read that. I'll never forget it. I'm up in Canada driving around these back roads of Canada and listen to Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And yeah, I vividly remember listening to that. And he talks about assets and liabilities. And then it clicked, that first house that I still had. I'm like, I was kind of starting to figure out, hey, I had some cool tax write-offs, but I wasn't really thinking deeply into, all right, I'm going to go buy more. But when I read that book, I'm like, wow, wait, what I have is now an asset. And I was able to buy it with a liability, and it all started to click, right? Yeah. So when I read that, I'm like, oh man, that's it. So I just immediately dove into bigger pockets, as many books as I could find, and just started reading and digesting as much as I could while I was out on the rig. And I always joke, like, there's a lot of time when in oil and gas in the field where you're driving around location to location. And for a while I would listen to, I don't know, I guess I would listen to games or I would listen to music, but I'm like, you know what? All this time I could probably make better use of it.
For sure.
I started reading all these books, and yeah, that's really how it spun off, right? So like that first, and what I like to show people is like, how did I go from one to two? So the way
Before we get there, I love that. And I love the energy. Man, you were an accidental landlord, an accidental investor. You didn't even know that you had an asset until you read the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad to figure out, wait a second, I have an asset. So you already had set yourself up without even knowing it, or maybe your parents knew, and or your dad knew. Maybe that's why he was like, yeah, you should do this for sure. But man, you'd already set yourself up to the road to success, and you didn't even know that you were already going on down that road.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah, until I had that realization. Like, if you'd asked me to define an asset and a liability at that point, I probably wouldn't have been able to do it.
You were a chemist and an engineer.
That's right.
And not an accountant.
That is exactly right.
And Rich Dad Poor Dad really has a special way of categorizing assets and liabilities. It's not the GAAP accounting method. It's if it makes you money, then it's an asset. If it takes money away from you, then it's a liability. And he even says that your house that you live in is not an asset. It's actually a liability because it doesn't make you any money.
No, you got to pay the mortgage.
For sure. So, okay, walk us through, how did you go from one to two? Like when that light bulb goes off after listening to Rich Dad, Poor Dad. So what was your next thought?
Yeah, man. Well, naturally I would, or maybe not so naturally. I'm like, I did some value add on that house and I took my wife up there. I think we had, it was our first boy. I just had one at the time. We went up to Laramie and her dad helped me and we kind of fixed up the house a little bit more. And then it got a little bit more rent out of it and improved the value. And guys, this was 2010, right? So I bought it for $160,000. And by 2015, it had appraised. I went and got it reappraised for, I don't know, maybe $240 or $270 or something. And what I did is I went to the bank, right? And again, I had this W-2 income now that at the time I didn't realize was this huge asset. So I went to U.S. Bank again. They did my first loan. I went back to them like, hey, could I get a cash out refinance on this house because I want to buy another one? So what I did is went to the U.S. Bank. I was able to pull about $55,000 on the refinance on the very first house, right? So with $55,000, what I did is I went to another smaller bank and I did essentially, I mean, kind of like the Burr strategy, but I bought a value add property in Laramie as well. And this one still blows people's minds to this day, but this house was right next to campus. I could literally throw a baseball and hit the campus. So University of Wyoming, it was that close. And it was rented for $730 a month, random number, right?
The whole house,
$730 a month. And I'm like, are you kidding me? And I'm getting like $1,700 on this other house that's like not close to campus and it's four bedrooms. And this house has got its own entrance, so it could be a duplex. So what I do is I go in, it was a 3-2 at the time. I turned it into a 3-2 upstairs out of the bathroom. And then in the basement, I finished the basement off out of the kitchen, made its own unit, made it a 2-1. So by the time that I went and got a loan from First Interstate Bank, which was like a local bank. And again, that's part of my story too, is like, I just started talking to banks and started learning from them. And one of the first, he's been still one of my best mentors and really helpers to this day, Kent Wood, never forget him at First Interstate. And Jesse Spann, a couple of those guys, I started talking to them about my options and how I should finance this. So we're like, well, what we'd recommend, Casey, is we'll give you a construction loan to buy this house. And then you go in and do those renovations and convert it to the basement. And when you're done, we'll actually have the bank take out that construction loan and we'll refinance it into a 30-year fixed. That way you can get the good rates and good terms and you get like interest only. I got all these different things that I now know and at the time I didn't realize was so valuable. And
they helped just walk you through the whole process, the banker.
Yeah, exactly. They're just like, here's what you should do. And this is what other people do. And they're doing well, right? I'm like, perfect. So that's what I did. And by the time I got done with this thing and refinanced it, I rented it instead of $730. I was renting it for $2,600 a month. And my payment, taxes, everything by the time I was done was only like $1,200, $1,300. So I was like netting over $1,000 a month.
That's incredible.
And I was like, and that was the second light bulb. It's like, wow, I just created $1,000 of passive income with no extra money. Literally, I just refinanced an asset I already had. And ran it, I ran a project. I mean, this is also a funny story. I was still in West Texas, and this is probably where I first learned how to do long distance real estate investing. This is funny. I'll never forget it. I'm out there on the rig, and I'm running a smaller site, like a little workover rig. And we're getting ready for the day. And I was also, but on my off days, I was down there trying to get this project going and get my GC and the plumbers. And I really didn't have a GC. I more had like, I was trying to bootstrap it, put it all together.
You're your GC.
Yeah, exactly. I was a GC. And then the GC that was in Laramie was now in Texas, in the middle of West Texas on a drilling rig. And I'm trying to coordinate all these people. And the tenants were still in the house and they were going to eventually move out and they were just being difficult.
So you were working on the house while the tenants are in the
basement, right? We were working on the basement first. I was not very good, right? I was not the best landlord, not the best project manager at the time. So I get a call that morning and I forget what the first call was, but the first call is the electrician calling me and then the plumber comes over and then the other like kind of GC slash like Carpenter are over, all over at the same time. And they're all asking, like, what's going on here? And then they cut the power. They didn't tell the tenants. The tenant was in the shower while they cut the power. Nobody told the tenants. And then everybody, and the tenants are freaking out on them. Nobody knows what to do. And then I'll never forget, the plumber calls me. And he was nice enough. He's like, Casey, he's like, You got too many chiefs and not enough Indians over here. You need to get this thing figured out and tell us who's in charge. And when you get this figured out, call me back and I'll come back out and do this job, right? So anyway, I got a little bit of a tongue lashing and tenants mad at me, and then I'm trying to manage all this while I'm on a drill site and figure this all out, right? But
while anyway. You're managing the drill site in West Texas.
Yes, and then getting blown up, and so it wasn't one of my finest days, but learned a lot of lessons that day and got better.
But you failed forward. You figured out how to create an extra $1,000 in passive income by going through and messing all that up. It was a stressful day. I'm sure that was a stressful morning.
Mm-hmm.
But you figured it out. And even with all the mistakes that you made, you still created something that added to your balance sheet and added to your pocketbook or your pocket every month. So that's a win.
Oh, yeah.
So on that second house, how much did you buy it for? Then how much did it appraise for after you did the value add?
Yeah, we bought that one for 160, put about 60 to 70 in it. So all in around, what, 220, 230? Yeah, and it appraised for about 270, 280,000. So I was able to get most of the money out. I got most of the money out. Yeah, and even after on the post-refi. So it really was basically like a burst strategy. Yeah. We're able to get most of the cash out.
That's great.
It was a creative burst strategy.
Yeah.
That might be why you like the creative things, because you just started off with the creative.
Oh, yeah.
That's wild, man. Man, that's a cool story, because I think that where most people in this world really start getting scared to take action is they're afraid to go through a situation like that where they're going to mess it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're afraid, like, oh, I'm going to mess this up somehow, or I'm scared because now I'm borrowing this much money to go do this deal. I'm $200,000 in debt over something I don't really know what I'm doing. And I think that freezes up a lot of people from taking the step that you took, which was actually going and failing forward.
Absolutely.
And so was that even a thought in your mind? Like, I'm borrowing, $200,000 plus to go make this happen?
Man, no, which is a blessing and a curse, right? Like, I've always been a risk taker. I had an asset down the street that was not near of a good of location. And I knew the numbers on that asset. I'm like, well, I knew, at the worst point, I'm like, I could go way over budget, which I did. I think we probably budgeted 60 and we probably went to 70, 80,000, but I knew that was the main risk. I knew it would rent all day and I knew it was a great location. And so, yeah, I would like to hope that I felt like I de-risked the situation.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you knew what the end result was going to get you.
Yeah.
You knew there was no way that you were going to, mess that up. Okay. So obviously you started off with the virtual or long distance investing. Did you keep doing the long distance thing? Did you try to mess around in Houston? Like, how did you grow from there?
Yeah. So I was still working in West Texas. By the time I did that project, yeah. Cause like my work schedule, I'd gone from up in Canada, right? When I read Rich Dad Poor Dad, I got relocated back down to West Texas and I was working there. And then, yeah, that was kind of the next phase was, like you mentioned about the creative, right? Like, because I got the bug even more at that point because I created that $1,000. I'm like, how do I go buy more of these? But again, I was making good money, but not enough money to where I could go put $50,000 down every house, right? And do that every 3 months. Or I mean, I could save up for another year or so and try to do that, but I couldn't do it fast, right? So that's when, again, I was reading another book was Brandon Turner's book, how to buy property with no money down. And so, like, I started learning about hard money, which, I mean, I remember, this is funny. I remember Googling at the time. I was thinking about you guys when we were in San Diego, when we were with this awesome hard money lender watching the game, right? And I'm like, I remember when I first read, I think it was Brandon Turner's book, and he's talking about hard money lenders. I'm like, all right, hard money lender, how do I go find them? And, like, I Googled it, and, like, you couldn't find them, at least back in then. Like, at least I couldn't up in Wyoming. And there was literally, like, no options of hard money lenders. But today, they're out there. They're plentiful, right?
Yeah. The dime a dozen.
Throw a rock in any direction and you're going to get a hard money lender.
Exactly. So I was just trying to figure out, like, how do I go buy more properties and keep this thing going? Because, I was hooked. So I was, like, thinking about creative finance. I was pitching creative finance. That's when I first started learning how could I go to a seller and try to structure a deal? And then how could I go use private money lenders, right? At that point, I made the decision. I'm like, okay, or maybe it's a year or two after that. I mean, I started talking on social media, and at that time it was just me like getting on Facebook and sharing what I was doing. And this is like probably 2017. And because I knew that was one other way is if I could partner with people and have them lend on deals. Because again, I didn't have a bunch of hard money lenders up that would do deals in Wyoming. So I had to finance it some way. So I was just kind of looking at all the different options. And yeah, that's when I moved out to Dallas-Fort Worth, and we had a small portfolio there. I had a partner who had some capital. He had like a HELOC that he used, and we used some private money from other people we knew. And we started going there, and we learned some tough lessons. But that was when, I'll never forget this.
What was one of the tough lessons? Tell us one of them.
Yeah, man. I'll start with the end, and I'll explain the story. But it's always have two exit strategies.
Okay. Right?
You guys, everybody should know this one by now, or if you don't know it now, you're about to know it. So we got this like false sense of like we had this thing down because we had a good GC and we bought a bunch of lower priced houses around Fort Worth. Some are even around like TCU, and these houses are probably worth like way more now. This is back in like 2017, and we found some houses for like one we bought for like 60,000, or we bought one for 80 and put another 80 into it, and it appraised for like 240. So we perfect burr strategy. We bought another one for like 120, put 30 or 40 into it, and it was worth over 200. So we're like, we did like four of these or five of these and built like a small rental, and we're like, oh wow, this is working. And we used that line of credit and some private money, and it worked great. So we're like, all right, now let's go do some flips, because we're talking to wholesalers and we're seeing all these deals in Dallas and other places in Fort Worth, and we're like, we start getting excited there, and we're going to scale this. We're going to go do flips to fund more rentals so we can keep buying, right? So, but what we didn't realize was we had a really good GC, and when we tried to go to the higher price point, we didn't have the right project manager in place. We also didn't have the right subcontractors, and we realized that we saw a little dip in the market in like the winter time, and I kind of figured Texas, you wouldn't see it as much. And also I think it was, I forget if it was around on the election time or some rates had just slightly bumped up too. So anyway, we had several properties sit, and we tried to go flip like four or five properties at a time. And then all of a sudden the first one doesn't sell. And now the second one doesn't sell. And now properties three and four, we can't get the contractors, or we're on contractor three and four paying for things three and four times. And we're using hard money and private money. So you guys have been in the business. You understand that's a recipe for a disaster. So fortunately, we were able to get out of that one, sell those all off. I had a really good hard money mentor at the time. His name's John Pribble. I'll never forget this too. We had two different hard money lenders. One hard money lender treated us like they were a shark. They were terrible to us. Like literally I called them. I'm like, we're struggling right now. We got to get some stuff moved. I can't make my interest payment next month. They're like, okay, well, and then they're like, well, let us talk about it. Well, 2 days later, like, okay, we'll be serving the notice of default on the first of the month, like the day you're late, and we're going to start to take this thing back.
Wow.
And they were just, I'm like, anyway, it was ridiculous. So, but the other guy's like, hey,
stress.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I'm still in West Texas working on the rig.
So this is in Dallas. You're in West Texas.
Exactly. Yeah. Cause I was doing 2 weeks on and then 2 weeks in Dallas. And then, yeah, but fortunately, the good lender was John Pribble, man. He's a good guy. He wrote a book too about private money lending. And John's like, here's what you got to do, Casey. Like I've been there. I know where you're going through. I'm sorry, but here's what you do. You got to, those properties that you're not quite done with or are done with, you need to drop them, put them on the market, drop them $10,000, $10,000 every week until you sell them. And this guy, he ended up getting paid back. It all worked out for him, right? Because he had underwritten these deals well to where that's what we did, and we got them sold. And he's like, don't worry about your payments. Like, I'm protected. I'll get paid when you sell them. And all his deals we ended up selling. We took a big loss. He got paid back, but it relieved a little bit. But at least like
lender always gets paid back.
That's lender right. Always makes his
that's
money
right.
Back.
Oh yeah. So yeah, we're talking to him and yeah. But I remember that call too vividly. I remember like being pulling over on the side of a highway in West Texas talking to him. And I remember being scared to death to call him because I just called the one, and the ones just were like sharks. I'm like, oh man, here we go again. What's John going to say? But John was good to me, and we got out of it. And so yeah, so it was some hard lessons, but and that's actually where the bar franchise comes in. Is I'd started the bar franchise
Hold
with
on,
my wife
before we get into that.
All right,
because we're coming up to a break, and so I want to set up the break so we can say thanks to the sponsor. But on the backside, we're going to talk about the bar franchises, what those are, what your mission is now, where you're going, and what you're heading towards in life, and then what your business looks like today. So stay tuned, Rounders.
Welcome back, Rounders. So glad you guys are still here with us. Man, sharing some great stories from Casey on that front end. Phenomenal experience. amazing lessons, so much more knowledge to get. But Casey, we want to transition a little bit. We want to hear you shifted a little bit. You took your real estate experience and you kind of went into small business owner mentality. Tell us about how you shifted from real estate and went over to the franchise business.
Yeah, you bet. And then, yeah, it's basically the franchise ended up saving me for that story. So we'll circle back. But my wife, so it all started in Billings, Montana. My wife was part of, it's called Pure Bar. She loved it. I'll never forget when she first came back. She's like, this workout is amazing. And I went and did it with her. I'm like, wow, this is a cool
concept. You went
to
Pure Bar.
I did.
Congratulations.
Yeah,
were you the only guy in the class?
Not that night. It was bring your man to the bar.
Okay. Bring your man to the bar. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I like that.
They still did it. But I did it many times over the years. And I miss still doing it. So she loved it. And I saw what it did for her. And I saw the community it built for her. So we were going to move. So at that point, I was going to get moved down to Midland. And we were in Billings, Montana at that time. And there was no Pure Bar in Midland. And Annie's like, I can't go to, there's no Pure Bar in Midland. What are we going to do? She's like, maybe we could open one. So I remember we met with the owner of Billings and we went and grabbed dinner and drinks with them and picked their brain and applied. And we went down to Spartanburg, South Carolina was where the headquarters was at the time, interviewed. Yeah, and anyway, got approved to go start a Pure Bar franchise in Midland, Texas. So
nice.
Yeah, and
which
I remember,
honestly, when you think about it, is a perfect market because there's hundreds of guys like you who are taking their wives out to the oil fields and they need something like that community.
Yes, literally. Yeah, which is, yeah, that's right where I'm going with the story, Andrew. So did so good, man. The Pure Bar in Midland, and we didn't realize it, but it was the perfect market because, yeah, there was a lot of demand for it. And then, but like, I remember like figuring out how to, so now I had to go finance this. And I remember we did an SBA loan and man, if you guys have ever done SBA loans, you think getting a mortgage is hard to do? Oh man, the SBA loan, I've never been through so much like, and we had to do like a build out and I was having to do like lien releases and it was, oh my gosh, it was, but it taught me a lot. Like I had to build out my business plan. SBA kind of helped me do it. And I had to go figure out, I had to pledge some of my current rental assets. Those first two properties I was talking about, those were secured. That SBA loan was secured by my first two properties.
Really?
To get it. Yeah, they did cross, which, yeah, they were protecting themselves really well.
Cross collateralization.
Exactly, yeah. My
SBA always gets their money back, too.
Exactly, yeah. Yep, yeah. So I went through all the hurdles, did that, and then, yeah, and then we opened our business and did really well. That me and my wife invested a lot of time in it. Man, I remember too, just hustling. Like I would, when we did the build out of it, we were trying to open. I remember working, this is terrible and very unsafe, but like I was like I was working the night shift from like 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. I got off
oil
at 6 a.m.
Working oil and gas.
And yeah, so I drive out and I'm like driving an hour and a half out to a rig. I was working on, we were working on a frack site, I think then. So I would go out, work the night. I came out in the middle and we had to get open. So I got there and literally I went into like just helping and I was going to take a nap in the afternoon, but we just kept going. And like because we were just trying to get open. And so literally by day I was hustling to get this Pure Bar open and then would go back out for my night shift. And I would find different ways. Sometimes there's some slow times. I remember in the frack van, you'd have this like wire line. So you'd run this like piece of you're actually fracking, right? So you would run down your little, it's called a perf gun. You run it all the way down into the ground, into the well. And when it gets down there, it shoots off a little explosion and it perforates the casing. And that's what allows the oil to come up the casing and come to the surface.
Okay.
So, but while you're going down 20,000 feet, there's about 30 to 45 minutes where you're just kind of chilling and you're sitting in this van. So anyway, I caught a couple Z's on those nights when I had to.
Catnaps between the perforations.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. But I was ready by the time we got on bottom. I got an elbow and then I did my thing. But anyway, so we opened this business and it did really well. And it the biggest thing though, I look back and we've actually all sold them since. But the biggest thing I look back is it taught me how to run a business, how to manage payroll, how to lead people. Right. And the crazy thing is I was 100% female. I was the only, all my employees were female.
Fitness instructors.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it was a tough model I ended up finding out in the end, but it taught me how to like all the HR stuff, how to run a business, marketing, right? This was the first time I started to learn like grassroots marketing and tracking leads and how to run a CRM and how to run a sales process. So I learned a ton there because at the time I was just a kind of a buy and hold investor that was managing some projects. I wasn't running like a sales company. And that's what, well, we can talk later, but that's what really supercharged my real estate business was I learned how to basically build a sales company. And when I started to figure out how to wholesale and apply all those lessons it just it helped me tremendously.
It was a natural like transition into wholesaling.
So was your wife, was she active in that business? Was she managing it alongside of you?
Yeah, so she was teaching, and it was helpful. I mean, our first one crushed it because she was involved, I was involved, they loved her, and even just learning people skills, learning to sell. I mean, that's another one that like I had never had to sell in my career, right? As a petroleum engineer, you might have to go sell even then I wasn't having to sell much, right? But I think about this when I read Rich Dad Poor Dad because he talks about doing door to door sales.
Yeah,
and I remember I read that book. And I was thinking at the time, I'm like, I have no idea how to do sales. Like, I'm not a sales guy. I was scared of sales. I wish I would have done that. Casey, you should have done that growing up. You should have learned that skill, right?
That's what you were telling yourself when you were reading the book?
When I read it. I'm like, dang. And it was just very foreign to me. I'm like, man, I wish I was good at sales. And it sounds like that's a big key to being successful. But the Pure Bar is where I got it, right? I now had to go sell. Like, it was either fail forward, right? It's either figure out how to sell or not bring in profits. So I learned how to like sell this product,
I want to back up for a second. How much did you have to borrow to do this Pure Bar?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it is, man, this will blow your mind. Our studio was, we kept it lean we bootstrapped a lot of it. So probably we took, the SBA loan was $240,000.
And then how much of your money did you sink in?
And luckily SBA, it was kind of like a house. We put about 20% down. 10 or 20% down.
Okay.
And then we took it out of an SBA loan, which had a favorable interest rate, and it was like amortized over 10 years. But yeah, man, it was like that much. But this, the crazy thing is, people were opening these things for investing $500,000, like $700,000 for these franchises. And once I learned the numbers, I was like, oh my gosh, that scares me to death.
We just did 240.
Yeah, we just paid 240. But as far as like numbers, like once we got it going, after our first real full year, we made over $100,000 in profit. So it paid down quickly. What it led to was like, then we're like, okay, wow, we could scale this. And I saw it cost me 240 to get off the ground. Well, there were four of them in San Diego, like about to go under, that I could basically get for free, but they're all losing money. So that was kind of our next transition, is we went and bought four of them in San Diego. It was three at the time. We got them. We basically got it. They handed us the keys just for us to take over the liabilities, right? They had the rent. Rent was expensive. They had the payroll. And so we bought those. And literally I moved out. Like, I didn't move out there, but that's the other thing I was doing. I was still working in the field. And I combined.
Still working in oil and gas. You have one Pure Bar open in Midland.
Yeah.
You have how many houses that you've gone and done as buy and holds at that point?
Yeah, man. I probably only had, you know what? That was the other thing too, is we had just gotten crushed in Dallas-Fort Worth. So we probably had 10 properties.
10 properties at that time. So you've got a Pure Bar in Midland. You've got 10 properties that you're managing.
Yeah.
And then you're like, I'm doing so well with this Pure Bar, I'm going to go buy four crappy ones out in San Diego.
Yeah. Man. Because the first one was making $100,000 a year. I'm like, and I could get these ones for free. I'm like, I could turn these things around. And the other thing was, we didn't have a good sales process, and I recognized it early on I didn't know it at first, but then the franchise got bought out from the top, and then they were showing all the new changes they were bringing. I'm like, holy cow. Like, I could see, like, they were showing us how they were going to sell, and I realized we have no sales process. I'm like, if we could leverage these guys coming in and giving us the tools, and I can go buy these for next to nothing, I'm like, man, we could. How do we not lose money in
for
this?
Sure. And in San Diego, which is a great market.
Yeah.
At least you think it is.
You would think. So, you know, and I say that, how could we not lose? The way you lose is COVID-19. We finally, man, these things, we finally were getting a break even, and it was hard. And, well, okay, the combination of the state of California and COVID-19. I always give my, today, even like when people bring me deals in California, I'm like, I'll do deals anywhere, but please don't bring me stuff in California. I don't ever want to do business there again. But it was so, because guys, it's crazy. Like, I finally got these studios to break even, right? We lost money for like 18 months to get them, to ramp them up, get good staff in there, get the marketing going, like get all these things in place we need to make money. We're finally get there. And yeah, that's when COVID hit.
And you're doing this while you still have your W-2.
Yeah.
So how often are you going out to San Diego doing this?
Man, that was the nice part. I definitely enjoyed going to San Diego. But what I did is I would work, remember, the 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. So you still get your paid vacation. So what I did 1 year is I took off my 2 weeks that I would have been on, so I could run 6 weeks together, right? So I had 6 full weeks. I went out to San Diego. And yeah, and actually I went without like my family and anything. I just went out there to hustle. They came out on the back end of it to help me. But initially I'm like, And that was when he first bought them. I'm like, I got to get out there, be boots on the ground. And I spent like 6 weeks getting it rolling. And then, yeah, I would just go out there, I don't know, probably once every other month to kind of check on things and get it going. And
nice.
Yeah.
So
it was
what,
a lot.
What happened to the businesses during COVID? Do you still own the franchises?
Yeah. Fortunately, we sold them. But so COVID hits, everything gets locked down. And then, actually, I'm still scaling at this point. Right now, I'm seeing I can do these in Houston. So I ended up buying two more in Houston. And my two in Houston, they were shut down. Yeah. They were shut down for like during COVID, probably, I don't know, 6 to 8 weeks, maybe tops. But then they started to let us open so we could get our business. Man, California, we were shut down for like a year out there. And it's like, it was so frustrating.
You got up to 7 franchise locations.
Yeah.
That's great.
You were up to 7 at one point.
And so, how many years? Like 2 years? Three years?
Yeah, probably 3 years. We kept the first one for about a year and a half before we bought the second one. Yeah, I would say 3 years. So then we had the 7. And that's the point I realized too, that like not all franchises are created equal. And that's a good one that I didn't realize at the time, but it was so even in that uphill battle it was to get to break even, and we were going to position these things to sell because we're like, I quickly realized I had a 50-50 partner who put up the capital. So I was giving up 50% of the deal and I was having to hustle my butt off all the time to get this thing break even. And in that franchise model, you're always just one manager away from quitting from your whole world being on fire. Because ideally you hire managers and they run it. But you couldn't, like the margins weren't there to pay somebody a really good competitive salary, right? We were trying to pay these gals we had one guy at one point like 40 to 50,000 a year, but even that was tough to pay him that, and it's in California.
Yeah, that's like working at the fast food restaurant down the street in California.
Exactly. You just couldn't keep anybody, and then I just realized it was a hard model. So I had that realization before COVID. That's why we're trying to sell them, and then COVID hit, but we were able to sell them and basically kind of break even, get most of our capital back. And yeah, and again, I always attribute to that was my MBA that I needed, that I didn't go, well, I spent a lot of time, and at least I kind of broke even by the time we're all said and done.
It didn't cost anything, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Just some sweat equity.
A lot of sweat equity.
A little bit. A couple sleepless nights, probably.
Yep. Yeah. But anyway, we got them all sold, and that's when I had the realization, too. That's where I was like, okay, so I did it all. Like, I learned how to run a business. I learned that that's a business I don't want to invest too much more time and money into. But I could go, I'm like, I'm going to go all in on real estate because now I know how to market. Now I know how to really kind of step it up.
Yeah. That's crazy. Okay, so, man, that's a... Talk about a school of hard knocks, going through that and having to learn that lesson of managing. You're a glutton for punishment with wanting to manage everything in other like states,
yeah,
in other cities. Like you're in West Texas and you're like, yeah, let's go to San Diego and buy 4 Pure Bars.
The thing that I'm hearing between the stories and between the lines too, which I don't even think you've mentioned, it sounds like you're during this whole experience, you had gotten married, you were growing your family, having kids, everything along the way with that.
Absolutely.
So yeah. It's like that's not even part of being mentioned here at all. But you've got kids come in, pregnant wife at some points throughout this. So that's, yeah, you are a glutton for punishment.
Yeah, you're right.
Your wife's a trooper, though.
She is, 100%.
She's got to be a trooper.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's what I feel. And that's the other thing on that business. Like I was having to spend so much time doing it. And then my business partner was in Brunei across the world, right? And he was great, man. He was still one of my good buddies to this day. But
how did you meet him? Hold on, let's back up.
Oh yeah, good point. At Shell. So I worked with him at Shell.
Okay.
We've been talking about doing some real estate deals, and then when I went to go put this deal together in San Diego, I needed capital for it, and that was my first. Yeah, that was really my first like entry into here's how you raise capital at scale. Here's how you raise equity for deals. And I remember I pitched it to a lot of different people. And I mean, and it was an easy story I could tell because I'm like, hey, here's the one that I'm crushing it with in Texas. Here's other ones I'm going to go buy for nothing and improve. And here's how we do it. And the franchise was changing. So I had the whole business plan. And I'd already learned how to write a business plan
from the SBA.
From my first SBA loan. Yep.
Awesome.
So yeah, so I presented to him and he jumped in. But he was good. I mean, he was a great guy, but he was a detailed oriented person and he wanted to be caught up. And so I was spending my nights catching him up, spending my days doing the operations. And that's when I quickly realized, all right, and having a family, like this is not... Yeah, the biggest thing I realized is there's an ROI on your time in businesses, and this business did not have the best ROI on my time.
For sure. That's wild. So, okay, you sell the Pure Bars. How do you transition from being full-time in oil and gas and getting into real estate? Or what was the next step from there?
Yeah, man, and then back to the – yeah, so maybe I'll go backward to when I said about the hard knocks we had in Dallas-Fort Worth. Luckily, that one I had in Midland had been so profitable, I was able to sell – I sold like 50% of it, and that helped me clear some cash to be able to get out of the real estate deals in Dallas, pay back our private money lenders, and kind of reset. And so I was in Dallas-Fort Worth. That's when I was hoping I was ready to leave. Like, if you'd asked me 6 to 12 months before all that, I'd been like, all right, I'm ready. I'm close to leaving oil and gas, and I'm going to live in up in South Lake, Texas, and we're going to flip houses and do real estate full-time and finally do it, right? But I wasn't ready. And fortunately, I was God showed me in a quick, not so quick, but in a direct way that I wasn't ready. So what I did is we sold the Pure Bar, moved back to Houston. So I moved back to Houston, kept my office job, and at least I was able to be around the kids, because being away from them was always so hard, working in the field for 2 weeks and then being off. And as they started to get older, it was just harder being away from them. And then I didn't just have one, I had like three of them at that point. So I'm like, I got to get back to the office so I could be home with my kids. So I did that. But what I did, you know what? But at the time, even though we were struggling in Dallas-Fort Worth, my stuff in Wyoming was starting to really perform. And like rents were going up. There was like no inventory. And I started the wholesale. Because here's the other thing is I always joke about like wholesaling. Like at the time I was buying from wholesalers in DFW, and there were plenty of them. And like we could just go buy from them. Right. But I'm like, man, I wish there were one. And I wish I had a wholesaler in Wyoming I could buy from. I'm just having to buy off the MLS. And as the market started to get hotter, it was hard to buy on the MLS. So that's when I started. It was like 2019. That's when I started my direct-to-seller company. And again, I'd learned all this stuff about sales and running marketing and running all that from Pure Bar. So I ran that with I paid for a course from these guys. It's REI Game Changers. It's James Hodges and Alan. Those guys, man, they helped me out a lot. They were out of Midland, actually. I met them in Midland, and they showed me how to wholesale. So basically, I learned how to wholesale, started doing deals in Wyoming. But what I quickly found was Wyoming was like this blue ocean of deals where there was no wholesalers. Like when I did marketing and I sent out a postcard, like I'm the only one talking to these people. And it was awesome. And I'm talking to these other people and these other masterminds. And they're like, man, when we talk to when we go on a seller appointment, our seller pulls out this stack of postcards. Like yeah. We're just one of many. Right. So in Wyoming was growing. It had strong rents. It still had good prices. Taxes are low. Insurance, still to this day, it's still a great market. And I realized, wow, this is a good opportunity. So I went back to Houston and I started to really invest more in Wyoming. I actually sold some of that stuff in DFW and I did a 1031 exchange. And I'll never forget this. So I had maybe five properties in DFW. I did a 1031 exchange, about a fourplex and a 14 unit in Wyoming. And the portfolio in DFW before I sold it was basically break even. I was property managing it, so I was paying myself a little. But if I had a property manager, it's probably like break even. But when I sold this and bought the basically like 14 plus four units in Wyoming, now all of a sudden I was making like $4,000 or $5,000 a month.
Net.
Yeah, netting, yeah. And it was all because of taxes. Taxes were low. Insurance was cheaper in Wyoming. Yeah. And then rents were still, rent to price was still in good proportion. So I did that, increased my cash flow. And yeah, and then at that point, I'm like, okay, I got to do more deals in Wyoming. I got to wholesale. Yeah, and that's just how it kind of spiraled. So that was 2020. I moved back to Houston, moved back here, and still here today. And yeah, man, I just started hustling, building the wholesale company, doing more deals, doing fix and flips.
All in Wyoming.
All in Wyoming, yeah, from Houston. So I basically sold off the properties, the portfolio in DFW, went all in Wyoming, and started building that up slowly. And I did it for, let's see, today's 2024. So I did that for a solid 2 years, just hustled. And
while you're still working full time?
Yeah, while I'm still working full time. And I had some good gigs. This is another cool gig I had. I worked for at Shell. I was able to get this job where I worked that same rotation where you'd work 12-hour shifts for 3 weeks straight, but it was in the office. And it was like 5 minutes from my house. So I'd go into the office, work a 12-hour day, still come home every night and do that. And then I'd have 21 days off, right? So 21 and 21. It was awesome.
Still on and off? Just shift work?
Yeah, shift work, but in the office. Because what I was doing is I was watching rigs in the Gulf of Mexico and just like full-time surveillance. Just we were checking. I mean, it was a role that was created after the Macondo blowout.
Okay.
With BP. Yep.
What a great position to transition. So yeah. So at what point, what year, we've only got about, let's call it like 6-7 minutes left. At what point in what year did you go full-time real estate then?
Yeah, so 2022, which is another story too. But basically what drove that was I was building it. I had a sweet gig as I just mentioned, and I had a good W-2 on buying more properties. I literally was able to grow my portfolio. I did a presentation at Collective Genius on this, where we went from 2 million to like 15 million. And this is that same period. I did it in like 18 months. And the way I did it was we were working with private money lenders. I was fixing and flipping. I was leveraging my W-2 that had a good income, and I just bought that way, right? I was buying good deals, and I was able to, and doing the BRRRR strategy, and I was going direct to seller. I was managing the contractors, right? Doing it all in-house, and it allowed me to grow really quick, right? So I built that up while I was still at Shell till 2022, right? But then here's where the catalyst was. Like now I've built a portfolio. I've kind of built it back up since kind of hitting kind of rock bottom, zeroed out when I came back to Houston in 2020. I built it back up and had good cash flow, had a lot of rental properties, had a fix and flip company. Because today, really quick in a nutshell, we do direct to seller. So we find all our deals off market. We have now in-house construction crews that do our fix and flips, and they manage our rentals.
So you have people on payroll doing your construction.
Yes, bingo. So. And that's been one of the biggest game changers for us because, after years and years and years of headaches and frustration with GCs and just not being able to move fast enough because they've got other jobs, which, I mean, understandably, right? But bringing people, and it's also a scale thing, right? Once I had enough rental properties, I knew I could keep guys busy. I'm like, all right, let's go recruit and find good contractors to do an in-house. For and sure. Now today, that's one of my biggest, I feel like, strengths and assets is like I can go in, flip a house really quickly and like solve a homeowner's problem and basically go flip their house. And then a lot of times we'll structure to where I'll pay the homeowner on the back end because I'm like, hey, we could give you our cash offer like everybody else, or let me go in and bring my guys who could start next week. We'll go in and flip this thing. And when we sell it in 60 to 90 days, you'll get paid more and then we'll make more. So it's a really cool
strategy.
Like
an ovation, basically.
Exactly. Exactly like an ovation. We just take the deed because we put a lot of money in.
For sure.
Yeah, got to control it. Yeah.
Exactly. Which is a whole nother. Yeah. We'll talk about that. We call that the Revive method. It's one of our best money makers these days is we do that exact strategy.
Okay. So you're doing the fix and flip. You're doing the direct to seller wholesale business. And then so talk to us about how you're raising capital and helping other people. You know, because your mission, you told us at the beginning of the show or right before the show, your mission is to help 100 families, you know, create enough passive income to reach their passive income goals. So how are you doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, the only last piece is property management, right? So Find the deal, fix it up, and now we can do property management. So I figured out that, hey, I mean, a lot of people just wholesale, right? Or a lot of people are construction and or they just property management. I was able to do all three. And to me, the easiest thing for me to do was go find a distressed property, fix it up, rent it out, right? But that becomes very capital intensive. But at the same time, not many people can do all three. So I'm like, how do we solve that problem? Well, that's when Bighorn Capital Fund came into play because I've been working with private money lenders for years and building relationships there. But I really just needed to have a bigger pipeline, a more efficient way to raise money. So that's why I started a couple years ago. I started Bighorn Capital Fund to where now I could work with. And a lot of these guys are the same guys I worked with at Shell, right? Or they're people in our neighborhood, people I know that don't, they're not crazy like me. I mean, if you've listened this far in the podcast, you could see not everybody's like me and wants to go hustle and do all this themselves, right?
Buy 7 bar franchises. And
exactly. So we're like, we built it out and it's like, but I've been in those guys' shoes, right? I worked in the oil and gas industry. We saw it where like 6 straight years, they cut 10% of our company. One year it was 40%. Right. We went through all those layoffs and I know how those guys felt. And I felt, fortunately, I didn't have the stress because I was building a real estate company in the meantime and I had an off ramp. Right. But those guys, none of those guys had off ramps. They were scared and they had given everything to Shell versus me. A couple years into it, I realized there wasn't that much incentive for me to go above and beyond for Shell, but I better protect myself and my family. And that's why I started buying real estate. So that's why one of the big catalysts for the fund and why I want to help 100 people achieve their passive income goal is I don't want them to have that same stress that all those people I worked with had where they're like, and I would have had too if I wouldn't have hustled to where I could be laid off at any time or just missing the family stuff. Because the story I didn't quite finish earlier was what finally made me leave my W-2 was I was finally built a real estate company and it was making good money. But I kept it because I had a sweet gig and I was getting good financing terms from all the banks with my W-2, right? But I was missing the important stuff with my family. That 2 a.m. to 2 p.m. shift, I was missing, it was actually 2 p.m. to 2 a.m. I was missing all my kids' games And I now had four boys, or about to have my fourth one, and I was missing those core memories. So I made the decision. I'm like, I'm not going to miss these games because of that schedule, I was missing it. And I basically drew a line in the sand with my boss and my employer. I'm like, I'm not going to miss these games, and if it means losing this job, I will. So ultimately, that's why I walked away from the job. But the reason I share this is because I want, like, there's so many guys too that work in the field, right? And this could be any job, but like where you're having to be away from your family and work is always coming first and you're missing those important like memories
for sure.
And those moments, right? I want to be able to give people at least the flexibility to have the choice, right? Because if you could achieve your passive income goal to where you make enough to support your family, then you can make the decision. Do you want to keep that job? Like I did, right? I finally, because I worked so hard and built up my passive income, I had the option to be like, you know what? I'm not going to miss these games, right?
So how are you helping people do that? We've got about a minute left.
You bet. Yeah, so helping people, so if people are interested, like first off, go to my website, just go to kcgregerson.com, and on our website, you'll be able to subscribe to the first step is our passive investing playbook, right? I'm played quarterback, did a little spin on football, right? So go to the passive investing playbook. So that's kind of like the first little free course that I like to people to go through, because that's going to help you understand like where do you fit? And where should you get started? And then from there, like we can get on a call and figure out where do you go from there. But ultimately, the passive investing playbook, start there. We're actually coming up here in the next couple of months. We're going to be doing like face-to-face workshops where people can come down, because you really, to take the next step, we got to figure like an action plan for each one of these families and what it's going to look like. So these two-day workshops is really going to be getting down to the nut.
When are you going
to
do those?
Yeah, we're going to start those in 2025.
Nice.
We're going to be here in Houston, and I'm excited to help. And not just, I keep talking about oil and gas people, that's I'm passionate about helping them, but I want to help anybody in any industry that's ultimately looking to create their passive income goal.
For sure. Well, Casey, man, we've enjoyed the heck out of having you on the show. Tell our listeners one more time, how do they get a hold of you?
You bet. So go to the website and spell my name right. Casey, you guys will see it in the notes, but kcgregerson.com. But yeah, if you guys take stuff in with Instagram, YouTube, whatever medium you're on, we put out a ton of stuff that we're doing, and I'd love to connect.
Awesome. Well, Casey, it was an honor having you on the show, man. Thanks so much.
Cool. Absolutely. Thank you, guys.